I'm not even sure I've got
that. Good morning. Welcome. Let's start our final session. This is it's going to be a very free-flowing session. The idea was we thought it would be very useful to have a session at the end where we could ask Mark to start off by reflecting on what the social sciences have to say, and then to give each panelist a chance to reflect either on the other speakers or on the discussion that's coming, that comes from today. We're going to try and keep this pretty short, keep our comments to a maximum of about 5 minutes, have an engagement, and then open it up to the floor. But in opening up to the floor, what we'd really like to keep questions very focused on our main issue, which is really about what does it mean to be human as looking at that relationship between the inner animal inside us, those kind of instinctive brains, and the way in which our frontal cortex has been able to repress it. Ideas around ideology, social organization, power, punishment, all those are the themes we would like to try and stick to, because this is a can of worms that just goes in millions of different directions. So I'd like to start off by handing the mic to Mark, and then we'll kind of go in the order of the talks.
Can we buy CDs of this?
They have taped everybody except Jeremy. They forgot to press the button. But we are also going to try and post the talks, at least some slides, up on a website. You're going to talk more about that. We're going to put it up on the CSSR website.
We haven't mentioned this to Mark or to Clifford yet, so this is the first they know about it. But I'm hoping that Mark and Clifford, as well as Nicky and I, will be happy to put up a list of recommended readings. Anything else that might be relevant. And I'm not sure how easily we can do that through the summer school website, but I know we can very easily do it through the website of the Centre for Social Science Research. And if you go to www.cssr.uct.ac.za, then at some point early next week, we hope we'll have up a list of recommended readings and other materials.
Summer school ones. Interfering there. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay.
All the lectures that are being podcast or audiocast will be available on our website. We also make notes available on our website, and we'll also any recommended readings, everything you give us, we'll make available through the summer school website. And the address for our web is on the front of your brochures. All right. So, and if you've got queries, just ask to speak to me, and I'll deal with it.
I will do what you asked me to do on condition that Jeremy redoes his talk. let's get the ball rolling, and as Nick has just reminded us, the essential question that we've been trying to address is how do we draw that dividing line, or how do we define the distinction between what is animal and what is human, or at least that's how I've interpreted the main task. And my main answer to that question has been, which I'll come back to, I will try and answer the question directly at the end of these comments that I'm going to make now, but I think that in general we tend to exaggerate the difference. That's sort of the main point that I was making. Genetically, we are less than 2% different from our chimpanzee relatives. Anatomically, modern humans only appeared 100,000 to 200,000 years ago. Civilizations or cultural products, there's only any evidence of them existing less than 100,000 years ago. The first towns, sort of permanent residential areas appear 10,000 years ago. This is all nothing. It's nothing. 200,000, 100,000, 70,000, 10,000, it's all just thousands. It's all just seconds. If you try to find an analogy in terms of the events or the sequence, the causal chain that explains how you're acting right now, if you were to only look back a few seconds to explain how you're acting now, you would have pretty good explanations. It will be, he said that and I said this and bloody hell, and that's why I'm doing this. That's it. But what, why did he say that? You know, who is he? And you know, why does it make you angry? And all of that. In order to properly understand all of that, you've got to go a long way further back than those few seconds. And that's why I thought we need to, in order to understand what makes us human, we need to contextualize it properly. And a proper time frame is something in the order of 200 million years. 200 million versus 70,000. That's sort of my main point. It's even, perhaps, there's a good argument to be made that we should go back 550 million, and I did that very briefly. But I decided to stick with the 200 million mark for the reason that all of the basic instinctual mechanisms in our brains, our modern human brains, our Ketonian brains today, are identical to, in broad brushstroke, by which I mean, you know, sort of like 98% identical to how they were 200 million years ago. We share those basic instincts with all other mammals. And I think that it really, therefore, is terribly important that we understand what those instincts are, because they're there. This is not theory, you know, this is not speculation. They're there, absolutely demonstrably there. It's a very simple thing to demonstrate in all sorts of ways. No controversy about it within my field. So now we interact with these other fields. I find it terribly interesting to listen to an economist and a political scientist and a few other things, and a criminologist and a few other things, listening to, you know, their perspective on what makes us human in relation to the animal in from the perspective of their different fields. As I listen to them, I must say that the overriding feeling that I had, apart from being fascinated and really enjoying it and thinking what a clever summer school idea this was, the overriding impression I got was that, you know, I was right.
It's, how can you say that?
It's a Freud called it the narcissism of minor differences. You know, we really exaggerate this little tiny difference between us and these other animals. But there really is, in mammalian society, and that's not an anthropomorphization. Within mammalian societies, within primate societies, there is a natural economy, without a doubt. There's a natural politics, there's a natural criminology. The economy of mammals, and of primates in particular, revolves around the control of a territory. And in controlling a territory, it's in controlling access to the resources within that territory. The resources, that is to say, the things that will keep you alive and the things that will enable you to reproduce. Owning those things. And then defending those things against others. Others like you, that is to say, another band of chimpanzees, another band of humans, same old thing, wanting to take those resources from you, how you control them, how you defend them, how you distribute them within the group. I think that if I was an economist, that would have to be the starting point for trying to understand what economics is all about. The economics of primate groups, of mammalian groups, of all animal groups boils down to the control of the resources in the case of territorial animals like ourselves within a certain territory. And those resources, you know, we don't like to admit it, but they boil down to things like who's allowed to copulate with who, you know, who gets to decide these things. The offspring. It's protecting my offspring against others' offspring, and so on. So these sort of exchanges which underpin economic life. I really do believe these things underpin economic life, and that we delude ourselves if we don't start there. Fear and greed, as they say. You know, I'm all for it. Any theory of what goes on in markets that starts with that, and with ownership of resources. This is mine, you know, and you just try and take it from me. And in fact, I want more. You know, all of this is driven by the sorts of things that we were talking about. There you're immediately going into a politics. You know, once you have a territory with resources that you want to defend, and that you want to distribute, you have to have a system, a social order, a system of governance rules. These are not things which are added onto instinct. These are things which are built into instinct. There are hierarchies within mammalian groups. It's not that I am applauding this or suggesting this is a good thing or apologizing for it. I just say it's like that. Sorry, you know, we just have to accept it, that it exists like that. In all mammalian and in all primate societies, without a doubt, there's a pecking order. And this has to do with, I'll give you an example of rhesus monkeys. There's an alpha male. That's the top of the pecking order. One guy who's in charge. And you know, does that ring a bell? That's how it works. There's one guy who's in charge. And then underneath him, there's a pecking order of mates, of his wives, if you will. And then there's a pecking order under that of their children. The last born is the most senior child. The last born child of the number one female is the most senior child in the group. And this is not negotiable. Last born. In that species, it's the last born. So the youngest kid of the number one female is the top dog in the kiddie hierarchy. And then it goes all the way down to the first born of that female. And then the next one in the pecking order is the last born of the next female, and so it goes on. You know, and you look at primate societies, this is how they work. It's not a matter just of brute force. There are a variety of instincts. One of them is a brute force instinct. I told you about that one. We call it the anger rage instinct. But this is a different instinct. And I'm going to say a little bit more about it in a moment. The point
okay,
is...
9 minutes.
Oh, sorry. Have I spoken for 9 minutes?
Just keep going.
Okay, now I'll speed up. I'm very bad at that. But you see, it's also like dominance. And regulation.
And regulation.
So, moving on to criminology. You know, there's also their rules of transgression and their modes of punishment which are built into these societies. Like, for example, adolescent males, not females, adolescent males have to leave the group. That's it. You got to leave. That's the rule. You don't want to leave, you'll get kicked out. That's it. You try and come back, see what happens to you. So, you know, all of these things, I'm saying it in too many words, I'm sure you've got my point, that they're natural systems, of which I think must be the prototypes for the economies and the political systems and the rules of transgression and punishment which we have elaborated for ourselves in our own species, which I think is so special and so different. It really is just the one that we know best. You know, there's so much that we don't understand about what these other creatures are doing. And it's arrogance to make us think that ours is so unique. You know, it's just not true. Now, there are differences, and that's what I'm leading up to. I want to just say in my half second that I have left, just briefly expand it, that the one instinct that I think is most important that I left for last in my talk, which was a very big mistake. I thought if I could leave it for last, I could then elaborate the most upon it, but of course it happened the other way around. It's called play. I think it's a terribly important instinct, and there are just a few things I need to underscore about it before I finish. It is all about defining your place in the social group. Remember, this is not a frivolous thing, okay? It's something that we're hardwired to do. Us mammals, when we're young, we play. What do? We try to encourage another mammal to play with us. And there's certain tricks that we use to do that. And then what we tend to do is games where we're trying out different roles. But the most important role is who's on top and who's at the bottom. You know, that's the essential. Who's chasing and who's being chased? Who's the king of the castle? Who's the dirty rascal? You know, who's the cowboy? Who's the Indian? Who's the cop? Who's the robber? Who's the teacher? And who's the pupil? Who's the doctor? And who's the victim of the doctor? And so on. And we try out these different roles, playing that being mommy, playing it, you know, that playing house and all of this sort of stuff. Finding our place in a social group is what play is for. But most importantly, who's on top and who's at the bottom. And it ends in tears when you find those limits of what's allowed and what's not allowed. Then it's not fun anymore, then it's not play anymore. But the 60-40 rule is a profoundly robust rule, which is massively important, you know, that people are willing, or mammals are willing, to be the submissive one in the pair, that always one dominates and one's submissive. It's always like that when they play.
But if it's more than 60% that the dominant one wants to dominate, the other one won't play anymore. So there's a very important rule there about what we're allowed, what we're willing to tolerate in terms of finding our place. There needs to be, you know, at least 40% of the time or of the issues that we decide, that we are the ones who do. And if it doesn't happen, then we don't play anymore. In other words, we overthrow the social order. We won't have it. I don't mean to reduce everything to that, but I think these are undercurrents which are terribly, terribly important. Next point is, yes, indeed, we inhibit this. I told you, you know, we inhibit this. It's a matter of degree. We are not only our instincts. We have frontal lobes which inhibit our instincts, which makes us unaware of them, which makes us ignorant of our own motives, to put it crudely. And then there's the other thing of us making up stories about why we're doing what we're doing, which is another uniquely human thing, the hypocrisy of it all. But it's not, it's a matter of degree also in the sense that other primates also can think. They also can inhibit the instincts. We can just do it more than them. So what is the defining difference then? I said to you, 200,000 years ago, we were anatomically more or less as we are now. It's not exactly clear. Maybe it was 100,000, but something in that region. You know, that's when we anatomically became who we are. Our brains, as they are now. Our instincts, therefore, the same. Our frontal lobes, therefore, the same. Took us a hell of a long time to start making cultural things, you know, sort of 70,000 years ago, as I said, Longbos Cave found these things. But then, you know, still a hell of a long time after that, only 10,000 years ago, as I said, did we start living in permanent settlements and building towns and permanent structures and monumental architecture and so on. 10,000 years ago. 10,000 years ago. It's nothing. Nothing. Everything that we're talking about in the social sciences starts 10,000 years ago. Starts 10,000 years ago. What happens, it's called the Neolithic Revolution. And what happens at that point is we start to control, remember the instinct I was emphasizing, this play dominance sort of thing, which, by the way, in adolescence becomes more and more about competition. That's what the games are all about. Not only in us, also in the others. And who, you know, who's winning. And look at our lives. You know, it's all of these games, it's territory and winning, and, you know, it's all, it's, and all of the wars and all of the everything. It's a massive, massive thing. Anyway, so what happens is we start to dominate nature. We start to control, we plant crops, and we domesticate animals. So we don't have to wander around to find the animals and find the things to gather. We plant them ourselves, and we imprison the animals so that we can eat them whenever we want to. You know, why did we start to do this? Evidently, it was because of climate change. That the resources started to become depleted, and so you had to stay put with your wheat field. You didn't dare wander off and let another band of humans come and take it. So you sort of got a permanent territory, and then you could put down permanent structures. And you know, I say again, just 10,000 years ago this happens. Then what happens is we get much bigger social groups, and much more permanent social groups. Everything flows from that. So all of the things that we heard about how we have cumulative cultures and act collectively and so on, I would be very interested to know what would happen to a group of chimpanzees that live permanently in the same place by choice, and it became a very large group. It would be a terribly interesting experiment. But I'll conclude with this observation. Please note that the 10,000 years in which we've been doing that is a nothingness of evolutionary time. We don't have any evolutionary tools for coping with it. We have to invent them. We have to invent the rules of how the hell do you live together permanently in the same place in such a large group. And I think that that's where the social sciences fit in. But I would just remind us that they then become elaborations of natural ways of doing it. They are elaborations. We don't throw out the previous 200 million years and replace them with the last 10,000. The last 10,000 are trying to find ways of coping with a situation that we have no evolutionary tools for. Thank God we've got frontal lobes which allow us to think up things, think ahead, you know, make plans, and look at all the evidence way beyond our immediate noses and other organs. Thank you.
right. So, I mean, I guess that's emphasizing the sort of root of property rights and territoriality, which I think are there. At all, absolutely. What's really interesting for me, I suppose, is the 2% and what the evolution of the complex societies might do to what it means to be human. So the narcissism of that small difference, I guess, is quite important. We were a hell of a lot better off economically than what a chimp band is able to do. So when Jeremy was speaking about chimps, I was really interested. So they've got language, they've got strategy, there were all sorts of things we didn't think they had. I kept thinking of Adam Smith's point. You know, has anybody seen a mammal say, I'll exchange this bone for something else? There might be bribery, there might be, you know, who's got access to resources, but the idea that we exchange, and then we allow the groups to exchange between groups and then grow, that's really interesting to me, and I don't know where it comes from. I'm not sure we do yet scientifically. Is there something in our brain that allowed us to do that, an evolutionary accident, something switches on, that distinguished us there? But that's really important. I mean, that 2% made all the difference, if that's true. So I think that the economists have got something to say about that. Otherwise, you know, just thinking back on what the crime lecture made me think about was, what are we actually defining as criminal? Yes, we might label antisocial actions as criminal. And that how we make up the rules, and those are just stories, and that different people tell stories. I think we all buy that. But I was wondering, and maybe Clifford can talk a bit more about this, Marx suggested we had some core values that came out of the mammalian system. Don't kill people, don't take children away from mothers. Isn't that something which is core and cannot be labeled away? Isn't this something which all criminal systems do, and Marx just alluded to it? We chuck them out, we kill them, we've got all sorts of regulations, and that in a way is going to affect the evolution too. I mean, isn't it when you throw people out of the group or murder them or execute them, isn't that going to have had an impact over time? So I was wondering what the criminal mind, the criminal had to do with that. It's not just socially constructed. Otherwise, I think I would rather just not say anything more. I'd rather hear more from Clifford and possibly later also from Mark, and maybe also from Jeremy about the chimps.
If we'd been sitting here 10 years ago or 20 years ago, we wouldn't be taking as seriously as we do today. That what we now know about neuroscience, what we now know about the mammalian and the vertebral nature of the human brain, and its importance in so many aspects of our lives. And I think that the work that neuroscientists do, as with the work of geneticists before them, it really proposes very, very profound challenges, very constructive challenges to social scientists in all sorts of aspects of life. So, for example, when we're thinking about unemployment in South Africa. I do a lot of work on unemployment, and we know that large numbers of people who are unemployed in Cape Town spend a lot of time sitting around doing nothing, watching television. You know, maybe actually we should be, you know, like, you know, having, you know, free dopamine kind of handouts. there's very serious questions about, like, you know, why under certain circumstances people kind of just give up and don't do things. And I suspect that a lot of the answer to that lies, as Mark would tell us, in the way that the human brain, like many other mammal brains, responds in certain kinds of situations. And there are all sorts of aspects of daily life which we can't understand without understanding our brains, our mammalian brains. Those are the very profound similarities that that Mark emphasizes and which we have to take very seriously. But on the other hand, of course, there are very real differences between humans and non-human animals. Mark actually used the phrase, how do we explain how we're acting now? Right? Well, I'd like to ask Mark, Mark, when was the last time you got into a fight? Right? You know, when was the last time your kind of rage exploded in, I mean, I'm sure your rage explodes. When was the last time your rage exploded in such a way that you weren't just verbally abusive, but you were physically aggressive and got into fisticuffs and all the rest of it? Right? I mean, actually, for the most part, that we live in a society where the way we act is actually very different to the way in which, significantly different, I should say, to the way in which even our closest mammalian relatives act in similar situations. And of course the reasons is, the anatomical reason is, as Mark reminded us, that our prefrontal cortexes are more developed even than those of our closest relatives, chimpanzees, and that our instincts override our instincts in a larger number of cases. Now, this might be something, you know, which is of, you know, in evolutionary history is of really recent origin, but it's really profoundly important to understanding why we're transforming the world around us as we see it, and chimpanzees are not, why chimpanzees are dying out and humans are burgeoning. This is a really important difference. Now, how do we make sense of this? How do we make sense of this difference? You know, where between the 6 million years ago, when chimps and humans started going down different evolutionary paths, and let's say arbitrarily 500 years ago, when people began to theorize the nature of humanity in a much more explicit way, when between 6 million years ago and 500 years ago, 400 years ago, how do we understand that process of change? Because there is a very profound change. When Rousseau, or when Locke and Rousseau, are trying to understand, you know, what is people's positions in political society, they didn't say, you know, let's play games together. Let's have a rough and tumble and figure out who's going to be king and who isn't. They said, you know, let's write books and argue about this and deliberate, and let's draw upon moral theories and try and theorize and moralize power relations in society. Now, that's a huge difference. Now, you know, it'd be absurd to say that humans only became distinctively human when political philosophers began to theorize that difference. Right? And it's not, you know, it'd be absurd to say that humans weren't human until philosopher X began to articulate the difference in a sensible, meaningful way. So clearly, humans were human, distinctively human at some point before that. Now, I don't know, I've got no understanding, really, of how we think about the changes between 6 million years ago and 500 years ago, which really makes sense of this really important shift. Right? Do we say that humans become, conceptually, do humans become distinctively human when they start behaving in certain ways? For example, that they do things that even now we think chimpanzees don't do, that they do all of the things that come with living in culturally complex, culturally cumulative, large societies, e.g., they begin to they have a much more highly developed sense of empathy. They have moral codes, which are in some sense rooted in or go along with empathy. It's very difficult to have, I think, a sort of a sense of social justice and morality without being capable of empathy. That they have complex hierarchies that involve exchanges and compromises over a period of time rather than for immediate reward and gratification. That in a sense, the intellectual, the cognitive, the moral complexities of modern human societies. Right? Do we say that humans became distinctively human when they began to do those things, which would then, of course, point to the fairly recent past, and might even exclude perhaps certainly hunter-gatherer societies up to a certain point. I mean, chimpanzees are hunter-gatherer societies in many respects, but a human hunter-gatherer societies. Or do we say that humans became distinctively human when anatomically, neurologically, humans became capable of that difference because of changes in our anatomy? Right. Now, I can't remember if it was Mark at some point was talking about this, not this week, but in the past. Unfortunately, the impression I've got is that we don't really know enough about the evolution of the human brain over the period between, you know, a million years ago and 10,000 years ago, to be able to really be able to say very much about the, if I'm wrong, hopefully Mark can fill us in, about how the human brain really evolved in this crucial period. Because all that's left are skulls, and skulls tell us about the size and something about the shape of the human brain, but not very much about what was going on within it. So it's very difficult to tell when, in a sense, humans really became capable of the kinds of complex social, moral, intellectual arrangements that, that underpin contemporary human society and certainly define our sense of what being human is.
You see what these males are like, they're very hard to keep them to any kind of rule. I suppose what I've come to realise is we need to think about time differently at another age. Mark talked about the Neolithic revolution. I in a way think we have a new era. The era before Marx songs, and the era after Marx songs. And I mean this quite seriously, because there's an era before we knew really anything about the brain and how it worked. We have an era now where we have a lot of science which is well based. Now the people that I was talking about, Hobbes, they were hypothesizing without any evidence. So was Smith and the others. And I think they did quite a good job, actually. If you look at Marx, you could easily turn him into kind of Marx language. If you look at Hobbes, too. He was talking about instincts and what they do and what they were like. And he was talking about how you inhibit them. And they did quite well, actually, in this. And I think we need to start saying we don't need to hypothesize about this anymore. We have a lot more accurate information. They also told us a lot of stuff that we can take advantage of about the inhibiting process. They told us quite a bit about that. So I think it's time, it really is time, that we start mixing and matching here. And we try to put these two streams of thought, you know, actually in together and actually play games. So I wonder if we took out the instincts and just used the rules, what kind of answers would we get? Now when we put the instincts in, how do we change those answers? Let's do some kind of almost computer simulations and predict, as they do with climate. Let's take this variable out, let's put this variable in. Let's see how we get the best predictions. And we have these variables now. I mean, I think it is very important to recognize that these imaginary stories that people make up are important in their life. They talk back on the instincts. I mean, Richard Dawkins, I think, is quite interesting on this. I know that Mark has some ideas about him, but he talks about memes as new replicating entities on the planet. He says they're genes which provide us with directions as to what to do, and there's a new replicating entity which he calls the meme to rhyme with gene. And really for him it's just a rule. And he says memes talk back to genes. And just as the human is, you know, he calls a gene machine, and he has in a talk I saw him give a picture of a London bus with Levi's on. He says, see there, there's a gene machine going on. But we also have meme machines. And the interaction between these machines are important because they're also directions for action. And they also make a difference. And I think we should try and get the ideology out of this. When I hear these debates going on between biology and the social science, it's so arrogant, and we can't say that we're like chimpanzees. I mean, ridiculous. So let's just get the ideology out of it. Let's just get over it. Let's get over the fact that we're not that special, which means, you know, we have to get over people like Durkheim, who were so insistent that we had to have this cut-out world, that we couldn't engage with other people on this, because somehow we'd lose something very distinctively human if we ever thought that we had anything to do with anyone else. And I think we've got to go a lot further than this. I think we've got to get over the fact that we're not that different to things, not just animals. We're actually not that different to things.
Clifford, you're not allowed to take us in a new direction here.
I'm not. It's very important, actually. Because it's how we people us who we interact with as humans. When I go to a big insurance company in Ireland and I ask them, please show me your, I'm doing it at the moment in my research, please show me your organization chart. They put it up there as the CEO or the VP, and I say, but where are all the things? Where are your computers that run everything here? Where are all the systems? Where are all the things that run this place? You guys can't do anything. If you call up OutSurance, you've actually just got a human interfacing you with a machine. Every answer that comes back to you comes back from a machine. The human can't challenge this machine. So, oh, we can give you a very good price on this. But you're not talking to a human at all. You're talking to a machine. And this is very important to understand who we are as human, because we're part of this world of animals and things. Now, we made those machines, but the people who made them are dead and gone and have actually left the insurance company. And no one there knows how they work. I just want to say it's a bit of a broader issue, but it's still the same issue. How do we conceive ourselves as humans in relation to the other entities with which we share this planet? This is including the parts of us that we deny because we don't want to be part of that group. You know, you see it's, I mean, to me, the way we treat animals and primates is the same way you often see families doing. Oh, I look nothing like my mother. I don't want to be part of that group. I'm very different from that now. I'm just like my father. He was a nice man. My mother, oh my God. I don't want to be part of that. And that's what we're doing. It's the same childishness that we had. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, it's now 5 to 10. I think, let's open this up, and I'm going to get 3 or 4 questions, and then we'll have, probably hand it to Mark, depending on what the questions are.
I wonder if we can hand the microphone around, because I can hardly hear people.
Okay,
who
do you want to
talking from the audience.
Will you tell me who to pick?
Just go for it, you know, the guy in the middle there, I saw him first. And then there's a lady over here, and him. All right, how about
good
this?
Good morning, everyone.
Straight at
good morning, good morning. I have a cat for the past 10 years, a very intelligent creature, but she never asked me about God. Now, my contention is that it was a regrettable omission of you, the organizer of this course, the fact that homo religiosus and homo metaphysicus was not included. We're talking about everything under the sun for the past 5 days.
Okay, is this a question? Can we have a quick question?
Yes, and I want to know why. Why did you...
Fine.
You took out this metaphysical aspect of man. Thank you.
Well, there's one here on the front here.
Good morning. Thank you for a very stimulating 5 days. I've got one question. Mark took us into the 21st century. The rest of the discipline seems steeped in the 16th century, particularly with Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau, and I can't believe there are not more current and exciting explanations of society. And I would appreciate if the lectures, perhaps on their websites, could post some more contemporary challenging views of society.
The guy, can you get the blue t-shirt there in the middle? Can you pass the mic to me?
Thank you very much. Fantastic series of lectures. 50 years I've been on the planet, I'm told the population of the world has more than doubled. I'm sure that in each of your fields that must be a stressor that potentially could change the way in which the humans make decisions about each of their economic lives, political lives, criminality. I'd be fascinated to know if any of you have any particular comments on how population explosion could impact on your fields.
Do you want to add something to say?
Add something to the first question, if I may.
Yeah. Can you bring the mic back? Sorry.
Well, I've got a very large voice. Can I use that?
Yes. Yeah. Keep going, yeah.
The question I have, which relates to this question...
Can bring in the mic still?
It's very short. Would you be able to say a few words about humans and religion, in terms of how this fits in with the nature-culture conundrum? This gentleman, I can't say accused you, but criticized you of leaving that out.
Should
we
answer? One more, behind.
Do you have any views on the recent publication, The 10,000 Year Explosion, which, contrary to the traditional view that genetic change has hardly happened in the last 100,000 years, is on the contrary, that genetic change is happening faster? I don't know if it's true, I sort of what you thought about it.
Okay, on the issue of why we left out metaphysics, religion, etc., I mean, these lectures come out of a much broader discussion at UCT, which involved philosophers and all sorts of other people. We just decided to select the social sciences, just to keep it manageable, that's all. And to focus particularly on how society, or how people have thought about the relationship between the human and social. So that's the reason. I mean, I'm sure that, so in other words, metaphysics and religion gets boiled down to just another story. That's just what we did. On the issue of population, I think that's really important because what's missing, if you had asked me what's missing, is what Mike was busy touching on a bit more about what was the process of evolution of our society and how the importance of agriculture and being able to domesticate animals. That really did allow us to have this population explosion, particularly the taming of the chicken, sheep and the pig has allowed us to have maximum population growth. Whether we've now got to the point where it's just too big for us to control is another matter. I mean, the problem is this is where the economists are right, we've got this massive system for which we've got collective action problems in it. Keynes would say we can't manage it up and down, but we're all stuck in it. And we've all got individual control, but collectively we don't have it. And this has to be the biggest challenge facing humanity now. The theories that Jeremy and Quinn were talking about were much more around societies and the state, individual and the state. Now we're having to ask about the planet. And so these questions about climate and population, I don't have any expertise on this, but for me this has to be the good big question about humanity. What was the other? Nature, anything recent on nature nurture, I'm going to hand that. I think Mark can comment on this. Do you want to add to those questions?
No? We obviously can't address all of the questions, each of us. One phrase has come up in a number of lectures, which I think is a very important phrase, a very important concept, is the idea of man as a storyteller. It wouldn't be surprising if some ingenious primatologist was able to devise some kind of an experiment which would suggest tentatively that other primate species are able in some kind of rudimentary way to construct stories of some sort. But it'd be extraordinarily surprising if any primatologist was ever to be able to demonstrate that any other mammalian species is able to construct stories in a remotely similar manner to the ways in which humans construct stories. Humans, for thousands of years, 10,000 years, 50,000 years, 100,000 years, I don't know how long, have constructed stories. It appears to be a substantially, uniquely human quality. And of course, it really affects our lives. Because humans construct stories, it affects our lives. It affects the way in which we respond to our instincts in ways which surely is without parallel in any other non-human species. Now that gives rise to all sorts of consequences. I mean, some of the stories that are constructed are religious stories, and those religious stories, like any other stories, clearly structure our lives in very profound ways. My suspicion, and this isn't an area in which I have any expertise, but my suspicion would be that what's distinctively human is that they are constructing the stories, not that they have a particular kind of metaphysical or religious content to them, but they're constructing stories, and those stories have, amongst other things, a broad moral content, which is about the governing of social relationships in reasonably complex societies. So humans are storytellers in really important respects. And I think that this is one reason why we pay a lot of attention to the early Enlightenment theorists, both in economics like Adam Smith and in political science like Hobbes and Rousseau and Locke, because the Enlightenment was a period in which stories, in which for the first time really human philosophers, political philosophers, economic philosophers, political economists began to actually really write down convincingly modern stories about the kinds of stories we tell each other in everyday life. Right? And in many ways, the disciplines that we use to understand the world, not neuroscience, which is of course of much more recent origin, but most of the other social sciences date from this really important period in human history, a very specific time in a very specific place, Northwest Europe in the early modern era, when people began to interrogate in a very important way this particular thing which is specifically human. Now, I paid quite a lot of attention to this because I was very intrigued in my talk by the fact that many of the issues which were so fundamental to the political philosophy of the early modern political philosophers, Locke, Rousseau especially, are actually the same kinds of issues that divide primatologists today when they're thinking about chimpanzee societies and what are the differences between chimps and humans. That in fact, that the issues which are on a cutting edge of contemporary primatology are precisely the issues which were on a cutting edge of political philosophy 300 and 400 years ago. And obviously there's a lot of very contemporary social science which will go a long way beyond, particularly empirically. I'm not sure, actually, that on this particular question, the social scientists have that was the big break. And I think it's the important one, and it's one which we can continue to apply when we're interrogating the nature of our humanity today.
Can I just direct the question about genetic evolution being faster and the issue of whether there is any scientific evidence that convinces you for the co-evolution, the interaction between the social and the cultural norms? Social and genetic.
So I'm just going to say one small thing. I want to reply to your issue about being contemporary. I think you're quite wrong about Marx. Not Marx. What Marx has done in the 21st century is take us back to 500 million years ago and to show how this history is important. He's taken his eye off the 21st century. And what he shows is, and I think what Jeremy showed and others, that we don't just get arrived here in the way Superman did, out of nowhere. And we carry this baggage of history with us, and it's the same with our stories, with our genes, so we have these ancestries. And I think what's important about the 21st century and can be more important, is to pay more attention to that. To pay more attention that we didn't arrive here in a little capsule like Superman 10,000 years ago. And to say in terms of our stories, I think both Jeremy and I told the same point. These are like genes. And you don't tell them because you're saying this is a true story. We believe in what Hobbes says and it tells us about who we are. But it's a story that affects your life. Story that you brought along with you through your church, through your parents, you this, that, and the other thing. In the same way as we have our ancestors who are reptiles.
I will pick up on the specific points, but I'd like to weave them together in a particular way. I think a good way of thinking about the difference between this human sort of storytelling and thinking sort of stuff, and social science stuff, and instincts and neuroscience on the other hand, is that the instincts are inbuilt, they're pre-programmed, they're kind of rules for living that are given, preordained. You just, when such and such thing happens, this is what you do. There's no thinking required,
it's feed forward. You know, this is what you do. You just sort of read out the program. That's an instinct. So it's a fairly, in a manner of speaking, stupid thing, you know, because there's no selection, there's no adjustment, there's no flexibility. And that's why we have thinking. And in order to have thinking, you have to inhibit the instinct. Think before you ink, I think is what was they taught us at school. You know, you don't just do something, stand there. Think. Then decide what you're going to do. And what thinking entails, rather than this kind of reading out of an automatic action pattern, it's taking in. So stop, let me see what's going on. Let me take account of the actual circumstances I find myself in, which are not predicted by my instincts. This is a wonderful thing, you know, especially considering the Neolithic Revolution. You know, this 10,000-year period where we're living in these large groups in this very bizarre way for mammals. Permanent structures, permanent settlements, large groups, no instincts to deal with it at all, which speaks to the sustainability and population growth sort of problem. We don't know how to deal with that sort of stuff. You know, so we have to think our way through it, and we overestimate our capacity for doing that. We underestimate the extent to which we're still acting according to these little mobs of 20, you know, and all that matters is me and my own. And that's why, you know, I fear for the, you know, thank heavens we're in the 21st century, because it's not going to be a 22nd sort of thing. But stories, so instinct, instead of instinct, there's taking in about how the world works. That is building a model of how the world works, which can temper my instincts, which can elaborate my instincts in relation to this other data which comes from my lifetime, including the cultural inheritance, what you're taught. Now, what that is, biologically speaking, is what you're doing is you're building a predictive model. And here's where stories come in. Stories are one of the major themes, including your question, which I'm going to end with. The stories are that. It's building a prediction as to what's going to happen. That's what thinking is all about. It's what the building of the model, the memories, the theories. You know, if an apple falls from the tree, it goes down, you know, and it lands there. Why does that happen? You know, there's a force behind us called gravity. Gravity predicts this will happen. Now I can work it out in all kinds of detail. This is, you know, really, really important. It's what we do. We make stories so that we can control the environment and satisfy our needs in it. You know, that's so the best stories are the ones that work best. Which is why, in the end, which is why, first of all, I'm saying, please remember the biological part of the story, I say to my social science colleagues. Because if you leave that out, your story's going to be wrong. You know, you're going to be leaving out a hell of a lot what explains how we act. But there's also a lot that explains how we act, which is not in our instincts. And that's why we need social scientists to help us to work out somewhere in the interface between these two forces, you know, is the real explanation for what we do. And we have good explanations for things that we have a massive experience of. Such good explanations, we don't even make them stories anymore. We call them procedural learning in my field. They're automatic habitual action programs. You just do it that way, and it becomes a habit. You learnt it. It's based on prediction. It's not an instinct. But the ones that are slightly less, you know, you're slightly less sure about, you still have to think about it. You still have to tell a story to yourself. Oh, this is one of those. What do I do here? You know, that's declarative memory, and it's a different type of thinking, working memory with problem solving. It's a more complicated. But there again, the best type is the type that works best. You know, the ones that actually predict what's going to happen so that you can actually take account of it and actually get the kind of outcome you want. When it comes to things way beyond your own experience, and here's where your question lies. You know, what's going to happen when I die? Where did this all come from in the first place? You know, why are we here at all? Etc. I have no experience of that. None of us have experience of that. You know? So our stories there become much more speculative. It's much more difficult to know. It doesn't mean that those questions don't exist, and there must be answers to them. But they're not going to come from my discipline. You know, we don't have answers. And I think it's very important that we recognize the limits for each of us individually and also for us as disciplines, we recognize the limits of what we know, what we can explain, what we can predict, and what we can't. It doesn't mean it's not there. You know, it's just that we can't control that. Now, here's the next thing to say about that. That's terrifying. Because those are the big questions, you know. I don't like the fact that I know nothing about all of that. And so, you know, it's very heartfelt. I don't know if you noticed, there's a ripple through the audience when you said, no, we decided we'll leave that out. Sorry. It's like, what? I thought you were going to walk out. You started packing your bag. I thought, you were hot. You know? Why? Because this is not something that's unimportant to humans. You know, I'm sorry I'm elaborating. In fact, I'm just kidding. I'm not even properly answering the questions. There's too many questions to answer. I just want to say this one last thing so that we can round off and I can pass back. Yeah, I'm sorry I'm such a greedy microphone person. When the first settlements, there's this place called Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey. It's the first monumental architecture, much more impressive by far than Stonehenge's little dump. You know? It's an incredible, incredible place, 10,000, 11,000 years old. And this is the first monumental architecture. It's around that time that the first towns are being established in the same area, this Fertile Crescent around there, Iraq, Turkey, and so on, in the ancient biblical lands. This place was for worship. It wasn't for anything practical. You know, it was for. And how do they know that? Because the people who came there weren't living there. They can see from the material evidence that they were hunter gatherers from what they ate. You know, they can see that these were hunter gatherers who came to that place, this big place that was built not for living in. There's no homes there. You know, then they had to feed them while they were there, you know. So there's even a very compelling story to be told, and please note it's a story, you know, in archaeology, that settlements came after the religions. That it wasn't that because you had settlements and lots of people living together, you know, that you had to have religions, and because you had to have a hierarchy and a moral order and a moral code and so on. It was, in fact, first you had these places of worship where everybody went there to worship. And then when they were there, you had to feed them. So, you know, better plant some crops because they're always going to come here. So, you know, we're always going to have more people here than the hunter-gatherer bands all wandering about. Then they come all together here in order to do some religious thing. So what I'm saying is, and I'll end with that, religion is an enormously important part of the human story. Enormously important. And that's why it's so heartfelt. That's why people get so annoyed, you know, when you say, you're talking about humans and you're not talking about religion. So, rock art, Bushman rock art, it's all about religion. You know, it's incredible. The more we've understood, there's a book, Deciphering Ancient Minds, the latest book of David Lewis Williams, Deciphering Ancient Minds, an incredible book. You know, so as we understand more and more about the origins of human culture and human civilization, so we see that religions are absolutely central to it. Therefore, the telling of stories and stories about these big questions which make us so anxious, about which we know so little and which matter so much. Sorry, you see, he's walking up.
I can't stand. Can't stand having to hear you anymore.
Clifford has to go to another appointment.
Okay, it is 10:15, but I think we can just abuse the room and just carry on for
5 or 10 minutes.
Can the genetic speed up?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I really would like to.
Sorry, go on. So, no, this